And now for reading and writing and radio.
All these talkers behaved freely, as though Susan, because she couldn't see them, couldn't hear them either, or at least did not count. But Susan heard far more than other people, and understood it better, too. She had nothing to do but listen. Hers was a world of voices.
That description of blindness was written by Lucy Boston, but it could have been written by you. WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University. To begin today's program, here's Ken Ost.
Tolly had spent the morning playing at being blind. At lunch, he discussed his morning's experiments. It's very tiring not having eyes, he said. You have to think everything out. But you know what I've discovered? After my eyes, the most useful things I've got are my feet. Not your hands, she asked. Well, you can't feel anything unless it's there to feel. There's an awful lot of emptiness. But there's always something under your feet, and they're quite intelligent. An interesting observation, Jackie.
That's a passage out of a book called The Treasure of Greenough by Lucy Boston, where Tolly, the main character, meets a girl, Susan, who's blind, and he spends some time, as it tells here, playing at being blind. To any child who isn't, there's a real fascination with playing blind. Think of all the games that we used to play that involved a blindfold. Well, I think that most of us, when we've played blind, we haven't stayed that way very long.
No.
We've stayed that way just long enough to realize how very dependent we are on our eyes.
The poem by Mary Neville about this, this is from her collection of poems, Woody and Me. This one's called Darkness, and this is interesting, I think. It goes, Woody and I shut our eyes and groped around the living room, bumping into tables and chairs. We wouldn't let ourselves open our eyes for a while. A person who's really blind never opens his eyes. How about a person who is really blind, Jackie?
Well, I think that a person that is really blind has some advantages over a person that isn't. We're talking here about writing and writers and what it takes to be a writer, and I'd like to suggest that for those of us that can see, that making ourselves blind for a while might give us quite a lot to write about, and it will also reveal to us some pretty interesting things about ourselves and other people and about the world. Now, a person that's really blind is going to know a lot of these things already. For instance, I have a passage here about Tolly's blind friend in The Treasure of Greenough. All these talkers behaved freely, as though Susan, because she couldn't see them, couldn't hear them either, or at least did not count. But Susan heard far more than other people, and understood it better, too. She had nothing to do but listen. Hers was a world of voices. Voices did not deceive her, and she could not see the smiles that were meant to deceive. She knew at once what people really meant, what they thought of the person they were talking to, and even what they didn't say. And another boy in the story says to Susan at one point, "You blind, but you see things sometimes when I can't."
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a long tradition of being writers when you're blind. One of the earliest writers that we know anything about is Homer. who lived long before Christ, and he wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey. Tradition has it, the wanderings of Ulysses, and we're all of us familiar with some stories out of both of those epics. Homer was supposed to be blind. And closer to our own time, Milton, who wrote Paradise Lost and is a famous British poet, he went blind in his middle years, and his greatest works were written after he was blind. Because writing doesn't depend on the images that you see with your eyes nearly as much as it depends on your inner eye, let's call it. Your understanding of things, your perception of things. When Tali used that word, how intelligent his feet were, the word intelligent means perceiving, understanding. His feet were understanding the ground. His feet were intelligent. Our ears, our other senses, our touch, our sensitivity to people's voices, to the changes in their speech, all these are ways of intelligence, of knowing something, of perceiving something. And we get so dependent on our eyes, that these are the things that tell us things, that we are apt to let these other intelligences atrophy, to waste away.
This is why I think I was always amazed at Sherlock Holmes when I was a kid, because here was a man who had sight, but also used his other senses so very much to learn all these, to deduce all these things. And this was unusual, because people don't do this unless one of the senses goes
yes,
by the board.
But we can train ourselves.
As he did, supposedly.
Yes, as Sherlock Holmes did, to discover what other things we can learn without our eyes. A blind person could teach us some of these things through his writing or through talking to us. We have a blind friend. She spent her early years in a school for the blind. She was born blind, and she's 15 or 16 now. And when she was ready to go to junior high school, she decided she didn't want to stay at the school for the blind down in Springfield, Illinois. She wanted to come and live at home with her family and go to regular school. And she was warned that she might have a very hard adjustment and a difficult time and so forth, but she wanted to do it, and she had a lot of gumption and tried. But an interesting thing that they did down there at the School of the Blind was that they sent home with her, when she went to stay for good, blindfolds for the entire family.
Oh.
And what they wanted the family to do was for everyone in the family to put those blindfolds on and spend a long period of time, as long as possible, experiencing what Edie's world was like. This, of course, was not to make writers out of them. It was to help them to be sensitive, for brothers and sisters to know that when they left stuff strewn all over the floor, that this would cause difficulty to their sister.
To appreciate her problems a bit more.
To appreciate her problems. I would hope that they also might gain some of the insights that a person who is really blind will get through the increased hearing of her ears, the increased intelligence of her fingers, of her feet. But she brought over some things that she had written, and we sat around the dining room table reading Edie's works, and practically all her writing was conversation. This person says, and then that person says. And in contrast, my daughter, who is her age, ran and got her own journal and began reading some passages out of her journal. And we discovered that whereas Edie recorded conversations and kept track of things in this manner through her ears, that almost all of Demi's perceptions were through her eyes. Demi's perceptions were very good through her eyes, but she was missing, to a large extent, the perception through the ears. Mm-hmm. And both girls seemed not to have much perception through the other senses.
Here's a portion of The Treasure of Green Knoll that you mentioned before about Tali and what he did, spending the day playing at being blind. He tried first in the house, feeling his way around the walls, surprised to find how difficult it was to tell that all four walls were not in a straight line, but had right-angled corners. The stone walls that were so imposing and certain to sight were gentle and curving to touch, almost warm, to be patted like living creatures. They bulged or sloped away, and their edges were blurred or broken off. The many recesses for windows or doors were deeper than the length of his arm, so that if he took his hand off the wall, he was quickly in empty space. And in space, even if it extends only just beyond one's reach, there is nothing to give a direction. When, after moving cautiously with outstretched hands, he met a piece of furniture, there was pleasure in suddenly recognizing a brass handle or a row of bobbins along the rail of a chair. But they never seemed to be where he had left them. Or sometimes, feeling out for the edge of a small table, his hands would meet a vase or a candle apparently floating in the air, which was startling, though it only meant that he was holding his hands 6 inches too high. He soon found that he was quite exhausted, so he took off the blindfold and went off into the garden with Orlando. After some crazy romping, he felt better. And then he remembered that blind people had dogs to lead them, so he put Orlando on the lead and put his foot on it while he bandaged his eyes again. Off went Orlando, straining like a cart horse. There was grass under his feet, then gravel, then grass again, and Tolly very soon had an unreasoning terror of walking over the edge of the earth. Although he dragged back on the lead, it seemed to him that they went like the wind. He had no idea which way he was facing. Every stumble left him more uncertain. Where was the wall? Where was the river or the moat? In a panic, he let Orlando go and pulled off his blindfold. He was still on the lawn, facing back to where he had started from, the only direction he had not expected.
There's another book, series of books, that are well-known and very popular by Laura Ingalls Wilder, usually called the Little House series. Laura is writing about her own childhood, even though she writes as if it's happening to someone else. And in the book By the Shores of Silver Lake, the story begins where Mary and the whole family have suffered from scarlet fever, but Mary, the oldest girl, has gone blind from it. And she and her family are on their way on the train to move farther west. Here is where Mary is learning something from her blindness, and Laura is learning something from Mary's blindness. Mary's dress was gray calico with sprays of blue flowers. Her wide-brimmed straw hat had a blue ribbon on it, and under the hat, her poor short hair was held back from her face by a blue ribbon tied around her head. Her lovely blue eyes did not see anything. But she said, "Don't fidget, Carrie. You'll mush your dress." Laura craned to look at Carrie sitting beyond Mary. Carrie was small and thin in pink calico with pink ribbons on her brown braids and her hat. She flushed miserably because Mary found fault with her, and Laura was going to say, "You come over by me, Carrie, and fidget all you want to." Just then Mary's face lighted up with joy, and she said, "Ma, Laura's fidgeting too. I can tell she is without seeing." "So she is, Mary," Ma said, and Mary smiled in satisfaction. Laura was ashamed that in her thoughts she had been cross with Mary. She did not say anything. But if you put yourself in Mary's place there, how did Mary tell that Laura and Carrie were fidgeting? Well, if I'm sitting there with my eyes shut in my imagination, that old ancient train seat covered with plush, mm-hmm. probably, is going to be jiggling and shifting. The train hasn't yet started. And this is the restlessness of her sisters. And then the sisters are probably, there is a feeling, you are feeling the seat moving. And then you're hearing your sisters sighing, no doubt, or giving little noises of boredom, wiggling noises, tone of voice of impatience or irritation. All these different ways, and Mary put them together and realized, to her joy, that being in a blind world didn't mean that she was shut out forever from perception. She could tell that Laura and Carrie were both fidgeting.
Now, we've talked about appreciating a blind person's problems and learning, well, their situation to a certain extent. But now, how can we use this in becoming better writers?
Well, I'd suggest some exercises. Shut your eyes right where you are. If you're at a desk or in a room somewhere, right now, try shutting your eyes. And keep them shut, no peeking.
Mm-hmm.
And keep them shut for quite a while until something else can begin to take place. See what you notice. What are the sounds that are going on? See what you become aware of. The floor under your feet, the desk under your fingers, the paper, three-ring notebook paper, the feel of that round, of the round circles, or where it's been torn from a spiral notebook, that rough edge. How often do we notice the rough edge of that, for instance? Maybe we never have. And then try writing these things that you discover. And so then I'd say carry the experiment further. Take it home with you from your school or your work. I'd suggest you do what Tolly did, that you cover your eyes. Try being in a room that you're familiar with. Then try being in a room that you're not familiar with. Smell, feel, listen. Try being outdoors and in different kinds of climatic conditions, say, when the wind is blowing, and listen to the wind. When the wind isn't blowing, wind has very many different sounds. I think that if you do this, you'll begin to discover that your hearing is getting sharper, that you're hearing things that you hadn't heard before, that you're feeling things both inside and outside of yourself that you're not used to feeling. You'll discover your relationships to people, too, are different, that when you can no longer rely on a person's face to tell you how he's feeling about you, you're going to have to get it with some other sort of senses. So I suggest that this isn't just a healthy exercise for being a writer, but it's a healthy exercise for living in the world with yourself and with other people. The more you can learn about yourself and others, the more you can understand, the better adapted you are to getting along. So try this experiment and see whether you agree with Tolly that after your eyes, the most useful things to you are your feet, and that your feet are quite intelligent. Maybe you'll discover that something else seems more intelligent to you.
All right, Jackie. Seems worth a try. And authors, let us know what you discover, won't you?
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.